This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Marissa Garcia. She offers insightful analysis and reviews on the airline industry. In the news this episode, airplane orders from Korean Air and Japan Airlines. Frontier Airlines creates a financial incentive for new pilots to remain with the airline. Lower reward values for frequent flyer programs. Landing your plane on the road. Changing the name of an airport. And jet service for your dog. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 795 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first our main man, Micah.
Hey, great to be here. Looking forward to a really interesting show, and I hope we get to talk about at least 797 topics.
I think we could. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's a bizjet pilot, a journalist, and publisher of jetwine.com.
Well, I have 798 different topics I'd like to talk about.
All right. I'm sure you'll find a way to fit them in, Rob.
Okay.
Also with us, well, as our guest this episode. Well, before I introduce our guest, I should just mention that David Vanderhoof is off this week, a little under the weather. And Max Trescott?
He's doing some recurrent training with somebody in a vision jet.
So both those guys are off this week. But we do have a guest, a great guest, Marissa Garcia. Marissa is one of my favorite aviation writers. She's the founder, the editor, the writer for FC Media. And you can find Marissa at the Flight Chick site, freelance writer. She's also a senior contributor with Forbes. She provides insightful analysis and reviews on the airline industry. And Marissa focuses really pretty strongly on the passenger experience. And her coverage ranges from aircraft interiors and technological advancements to aviation safety, regulations, airline branding, and even marketing strategies. So Marissa, it's great to have you finally on the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here with all of you.
You and I have talked previously, I think last on the PAX X podcast, but we've never had you on this podcast, and I haven't ever met you outside of that. I just learned recently that you had a career prior to all this where you were involved in designing and manufacturing aircraft interiors and other safety equipment.
Yes, I've been locked up in hangars trying to fix seats. in Oberhafenhofen with the 38 program. Yeah, I've been working in interiors. That's how I started. And with life rafts and life jackets, the survival gear. So doing a lot of testing there with the FAA. It was a really wonderful and extremely thrilling career. Honestly, I enjoyed it very, very much. Then later, when that ended, I took a little bit of a break, about 2 years, just to, I guess, get my bearings again from all that travel. And then I started thinking about writing, and I was like, well, you know, I know aviation, so I should write about that. and I got started with the Flight Chick website. And from there, everything else just sort of developed. It's also Aircraft Interiors International magazine. I used to advertise there all the time and sometimes write market articles related to our products. And so I reached out to the editor there, Adam Gavin, and he was just so lovely. I said, you know, would you give me work? And he said, sure. And, you know, it's been just a really fun career change and very, very rewarding.
And you reside in Denmark now. Mm-hmm. It's the middle of the night for you. I'm really kind of surprised that you said you'd come on.
It's 2 o'clock in the morning, but, you know, after the career I had, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with the AOG concept, aircraft on ground. I did a lot of aircraft on ground time. So I'm used to just whatever time it is, we'll just get to work.
All right. Well, we're going to jump right into some of the news from the past week. We want to get started with that, certainly, before Marissa falls asleep in her chair there in Denmark.
We've never had that happen before, have we?
Have we ever had a guest fall asleep on the...
No, only hosts.
Only hosts, right. So if it happens, Marissa, you will be the first. I mean, no pressure or anything, but, you know, I just thought I'd mention that.
All right. Well, let's get started with some of the news, some aircraft orders in the news. Now, of course, these things are happening all the time, but a couple in particular. And Marissa has written about these. You have Korean Air and Japan Airlines. Korean Air announced an order for 33 A350 family aircraft. That's 27 A350-1000s and 6 A350-900s. That deal valued at $13.7 billion U.S. And then Japan Airlines is going to acquire 21 Airbus A350-900s, along with 11 A321neos and 10 Boeing 787s. Dash nines. Marissa, are these two airlines placing these orders for the same reasons, or are we looking at different strategies here, do you think?
Well, I think part of it is that there's going to be a lot of demand for larger capacity aircraft, longer routes, and these airlines are positioning themselves to meet that demand. It's been a challenging time for the Asian carriers because they came out of the COVID recovery much later than other countries like the U.S. and Europe. So now they're catching up with their market demand. And definitely it's an exciting set of announcements for both manufacturers. I always think it's kind of funny that most airlines try to keep all allies happy, you know, give some Airbus orders, give some Boeing orders, and just kind of make everyone pleased. But I'm most excited to see what Korean Air will do with the new A350s. Japan Airlines, I was extremely impressed with what they did with theirs, with the interiors. And of course, also they have the A350s that fly domestic, which, you know, they have that much capacity on domestic flights that they could fill an A350 for, you know, relatively short flights. So, yeah, I think it's just good planning on their part.
Have the order numbers changed between Boeing and Airbus since all this Boeing stuff has gone on? Has Airbus improved their orders or have their numbers jumped?
In the narrow bodies, yes. Airbus has taken a massive lead. But in wide bodies, no. Boeing is holding its own there. So it's sort of a little bit of a split. This last delivery report, I think they only had an advantage of one wide-body aircraft, Boeing being to the advantage. But overall, they've been holding strong on the wide-body planes. So, but Airbus is definitely taking the lead on the narrow bodies, which is why, you know, I think there's an opportunity there for innovation on aircraft.
Now, I understand Japan Airlines has three A350-1000s in service, right? Didn't they just recently, or this year, I guess, or maybe in January, early this year, they debuted new cabins on their Dash 1000s, enclosed suites, Safran suites, in-seat audio and business and first class, and a really comfortable sounding layout, first class, six seats in first class with a 111 layout. 54 business class seats. That's in a 1-2-1 layout. And then the premium economy seats in a 2-4-2 layout. That's premium economy. And then the economy, 155 economy seats in a 3-3-3 layout. That ought to be a pretty comfortable aircraft to fly in, the A350.
It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. And yes, I think that Japan Airlines has always prioritized passenger comfort. They really try to maintain a cabin that is extremely where people can feel at ease, and they think about ergonomics a lot. They prioritize that in terms of considering long haul travel. And so I was very impressed with what they did with their A350-1000 cabin. But again, I think that we're going to see a lot more of that coming up around the globe, because it's really shifting. For many, many years, and Max, you've read my website for, I think, since I started. I argued that premium economy was the ideal sort of cabin for airlines to get revenue. And after years of arguing that, it seems to have proved true. You know, all of the airlines are benefiting from that cabin. Emirates finally adopted it after years of hesitation. Delta Airlines has, and United have both boasted of tremendous revenue from their premium economy cabins, as well as Lufthansa. So, you know, I think the way that it was going is just having that middle class cabin be more available for leisure travelers, which are rising numbers, who want to have comfortable flights. But there's still a huge market for very high net worth individuals who want to have extreme comfort. And the business class has been dramatic. I mean, I can tell you when I started, we were really excited about having worked on a development for American Airlines First Class, which was a recliner chair. Mm. So it was a premium economy chair, and that was First Class at the time. So we've come a long way in terms of improving comfort on the aircraft. And to see today, the suites in business class are just amazing. And the possibilities for a First Class, where it's more like a private jet experience for people, it's going to be fewer seats. You're not going to see a lot of those big suites. Like Emirates has this wonderful one where they have the fake windows for the people sitting in the middle so they can still see out based on the camera view from outside, and all of these lovely things. You're not going to see a lot of those coming out, but you're going to see something along those lines starting to come back. Qatar Airways just recently announced that they're going to be making the absolute best first class that anybody's ever seen. We're excited to find out what that looks like. So yeah, there's just so many possibilities.
But nobody asks what it costs, I guess, do they?
Oh, it costs an arm, a leg, and your grandchildren.
If you have to ask, you can't afford it. It's one of those things.
You're right.
For the longest time, first class is being phased out. United just got rid of it recently in favor of all business class, and then they started their Polaris class service, which is really just another name for business class. And I'm wondering where else you see it happening. I mean, Emirates always had it. British Air, I think they still have a few first class seats. I'm not sure. Where else do you see it going? Do you think it'll ever come back to the U.S. domestic carriers?
Eventually it will, I think, because their counterparts overseas are going to start to compete in that space. So sub carriers, I expect, are going to introduce very limited cabins. So if you look at what Swiss did with their new aircraft, where they have these extremely exquisite but very space conservative first class suites, and a very limited number, but it's just the right amount. So there's three technically, but the one in the middle is a double, so it could fit a couple. And that's it, just one row, and it's enough to meet the demand, but it allows them to add quite a considerable revenue uptick and appeal to those people who want to have absolute privacy, who don't want to be seen, or who don't want to be in, because business class has now expanded to where you have a ridiculous amount of people in the same business class cabin. So it's that popular. But there are going to be a few people who just don't want that. They're going to want something. There's always someone who wants something different. So although people have said first class is dead, I never really believed that. And the reason not is, again, I started with first class that was a recliner chair. So if you tell me that first class is dead, but business class looks like a suite, I can't, you know, it's like, it's really just not, it's not business class. It's whatever you want to call it class, but it's a major upgrade.
The other question I had, and not that I'm much for conspiracy theories, but do you think that premium economy is coming back as a huge revenue source because the airlines purposely made economy class so miserable that nobody wants to sit there anymore?
Well, okay. There is a there is an argument for avoiding pain. But, you know, the reality is that people over-romanticize what economy class used to be like. Because we built those seats. Those were hard cushions. They were meant to be flotation devices. So you were sitting on cork. There's no way that it was, you know, significantly more comfortable. And the back cushions were also hard foam. So they took up a lot of space and they were bulkier. All we've done over the years is eliminate that for the most part, remove a lot of that bulk and make it more ergonomically tailored so that, yes, airlines can squeeze a few more seats together without giving too much. Some airlines have taken that to the extreme, understood. And also people have changed in terms of some people are taller than they were back when, and some people are wider than they were back there. But it's myself included. But basically, it's just it's not that much about whether people are trying to avoid economy, but that there is a really good argument for premium and economy. And I'll explain. Not only is it special occasion leisure travelers who want to, they don't want to pay for full business class seat. Maybe that's not in their travel budget, but they certainly want to have a little bit extra VIP treatment, a little, you know, champagne, a little nice, and a more comfortable long haul flight. So they'll pay up for premium economy. That's a more accessible markup. And then you have business people who are not the executives. Everybody always forgets that most business people who travel are not high-ranking executives, and they can't get away with explaining to accounting that they paid for a business class ticket because, you know, someone's going to come back and question that that expense report. But they can get away with saying, well, you know, it was a very long flight, so I think I earned a premium economy seat. And most companies will give a nod to that without a major objection. That's the real marketplace there. It's a perfect middle ground. But it's, again, but there's always going to be a market for those who want more, always. And the reality is that while it's been a strained economy and there have been a lot of challenges for the world to encounter in the past few years, there's a lot of people who are more affluent, you know, and have the ability to say, okay, I'm going to just treat myself to something special. But I don't really want to fork out $250,000 for a private jet hire. So I guess it's not that unreasonable for me to pay $35,000 to fly first class, you know, whatever. It's just, it's a matter of degree, you know?
Yeah. Well, if you go back, I don't know, 10 or 15 years when I was doing a lot of international travel for business, yeah, particularly to Asia, I didn't fly on all. I didn't fly on Korean Air, but I flew on Japan Airlines, Singapore, ANA. But when I think about the passenger experience from those flights, there's the equipment, you know, the seating and the cabin and all that. But that's not all of the passenger experience, the in-flight passenger experience. I don't want to kind of diss cabin crew, but there really was a huge difference between what you'd get with an Asian airline and a U.S.-based carrier in that regard. Is it still the same way? Because I haven't flown internationally in quite a while.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is. And what's interesting is, though, that and it's a tragic thing I'm about to discuss, but it's important in this context. They definitely prioritize service. And they go through, you know, you talk about Singapore Airlines, the training that they give the cabin crew. I've been in the facility. It's just incredible. Same thing for Emirates. Extremely thorough training. And the same is true of Japan or Korea and several others. But here's the thing. They also are extremely strict in training for safety. They emphasize that. And it shows in the effective evacuation of the Japan Airlines aircraft at the beginning of the year. Because here you have people who are used to giving, you know, being very pleasant and being very amicable to their customers. But when time came to get people off that plane, those flight attendants knew to give the orders and not to budge. They were not scared of it at all. They just got everybody off that plane. And that was fortunate because they saved everyone's lives. So it's really about training and priorities. And we shouldn't assume that just because a flight attendant is being friendly on a flight or, you know, trained very, very well for service, that's really just their marketing side of their job. But then there's the real job, which is to keep everyone on that plane alive. And I think I have just a very profound admiration for cabin crew for that reason. I've seen that's of all cabin crew around the world. And, you know, I think that in certain markets, it's maybe less customer friendly or in certain carriers, you know. But I think for the most part, it's an important service that cabin crew give to their passengers.
Rob, were you going to say something?
Do you feel that the international service on American carriers, you know, United, American, their service compares to the what we would call the international carriers from Asia or Europe or whatever? Are they on par, or do we still fall behind there?
That's kind of a tricky question because it really depends on your flight. You know, I think that for the most part, yes. I think that flight attendants give very good service. If you're, U.S. carrier flight attendants give good service if you're in most flights, but they can have. I can only speak from personal experience. I've flown with every single carrier at some point or other, ranging from the low-cost carriers to, you know, the extremely upscale ones. And Ryanair crew have been very friendly and very amicable. Southwest Airlines crew have been lovely on flights. American Airlines crew have been great. United Airlines crew have been great. Sometimes crew have a bad day, you know, and on one flight in particular, I remember I was exhausted. I was flying, I think it was my third trip in as many weeks across, you know, this time it was across the Atlantic with a particular U.S. carrier that I will not name because it's not fair. It was just one flight. But I fell asleep right away, and I was asleep for the entire flight. And I woke up about 30 minutes before landing, traveling in economy because most of the time my business was extremely budget friendly. So they did not fork it out for me to fly first class. And I was dying of thirst, completely dehydrated. And I asked the flight attendant as she passed by if I could have a glass of water. And she barked at me. It was just extremely upsetting. So, yeah, it can happen. You can have that. And then that's the thing people remember. It stuck with me for a very long time. And it really affected my opinion of the brand for a very long time. So that's I think, where training is so important, that you avoid those moments.
I think that really makes a lot of sense because, you, I, we had a premium economy, I think, is that what you called it? We came back from Rome on United Premium Economy last summer, and it was nice flight, but it was very long. It was 10 hours or something, and I had my earphones, and Nancy had forgotten hers. So I just said to the flight attendant, can we get some headphones or something so my wife can listen to the, she said, oh, we don't give out headphones. And I said, well, I'm not asking to keep it. I just want to borrow one for the 10 hours. She said, oh, we don't even stock them anymore. And I said, you're kidding me. So we're going to make this 10 hour flight from Rome back to Chicago, and you don't have any kind of listening. Did you assume everybody brings their own? I mean, wouldn't it have been nice if somebody had mentioned that before we got out of the airplane? We could have gone to the local shop there somewhere in Rome and picked up some earbuds or something. But of course, once you're on the airplane, it's too late. But that gave me a really sour taste in my mouth for United. But of course, you know, it could just as easily have been Delta or American or some other carrier. And if you kept a grudge going with all of them, you'd never be able to fly anywhere because they all have a bad day, week, month, what have you.
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to say one more thing. If you want to hear more discussion about airlines and airline service, Brian Coleman and I do a podcast called The Journey is a Reward. And we're reviewing airlines. We're reviewing certain flights. And if you want to hear more about that, you can tune in there. If anything that we have said this evening offends you, you can write to iamreallyoffended@yahoo.com. That is an email address that Brian gets, and we will take the criticism there and probably use it on the air.
And do you know, I knew that last summer when we were traveling, and I told the flight attendant, I said, I know Brian Coleman and Micah from, you know, The Journey's the Reward.
Did that get you
that
anything?
Didn't impress her at all. No, it didn't. So sorry, guys.
All right. We have an item from paddleyourowncanoe.com. Frontier Airlines will make new hire pilots pay nearly $60,000 if they leave the airline within 2 years. This is the new Frontier Training Cost Repayment Agreement. And I think you can kind of see where this is going, that when you hire a new pilot, when an airline hires a new pilot and trains them, there's a significant cost to that. And if that pilot ends up taking off for another position, another job, another airline or something else, that cost of training is lost. So under the new agreement, which this takes effect, May 1st, 2024, that if a pilot leaves within 2 years, then they will be required to pay a prorated portion of the training cost, which is currently estimated at $59,190. Frontier says, well, okay, this is popular for some European low-cost carriers. This is something new for them. I don't know if there is a significant problem with Frontier pilots skipping out soon after receiving their training. But, I mean, I can kind of understand it. Do you think this is a crazy thing to do or something that just makes good business sense for the airline?
This is not a new concept. I think what we're seeing right now is that we have been inundated with people saying, oh, my God, there aren't enough pilots. If you have a pulse, we will hire you. And when there's that kind of demand, the airlines are like, anybody we can get, we're not going to worry about it. But if you look back in time, maybe not 5 years ago, but certainly in the last decade, certainly the regionals were well known for this kind of thing, because they felt it was the only way they could balance their expenses on the back of the, it's not really on the back of the employee. I mean, you're going to work for the company anyway. All they're trying to do is protect you know, against someone leaving after a year. And but corporate aviation business has done this for a long, long time. But again, it's all based on demands. And when there are not enough pilots, you can't really get anywhere with this kind of a policy. But now that the hiring is starting to slow down a little bit, I think Frontier's on the cutting edge of saying, you know what, we're going to cover ourselves here. Although, honestly, and I only know this from the business aviation side, these contracts have been proven time and again not to be enforceable. So, you know, again, but I couldn't take a job with somebody, and if they told me, yeah, we really need you to stay this long, or else we don't want you, I'd probably have to give it some second thought. But, you know, again, apparently, you know, Frontier has decided they want to hang on to people a little longer.
I think in reading the article that the editors at Paddle Your Own Canoe really missed the lead completely. The second half of the article is far more interesting and far more impactful than the first half, where it talks about how Frontier Airlines has just changed its business strategy that's going to rely on out-and-back flying instead of going on three-day trips. Now, that's fine. That's the European model. That's what Southwest has been doing. That's what many low-cost carriers do. But this is a real problem for the flight attendants. And the Association of Flight Attendants is saying that the vast majority of Frontier's crew members don't live close to their home bases. And they commute, sometimes more than 90 miles by air or by car or whatever. And that means that these flight attendants rely on multi-day trips where they spend the night in a different city at Frontier's expense. That makes complete sense. But if they're going to be going out and back, the flight attendants will be at their home base, meaning they're responsible for their own room and board, and they have to find a place to stay. And it's going to cost them a fortune. And as we know, flight attendants really don't make a lot of money compared to pilots. So the union has demanded that Frontier goes into negotiations and rewrite the flight attendants contract. And this could be a major thing for them. That's the real story here. Having to pay for your own training? Yeah, I can see that. But this is something new.
Yeah, I agree with you, Micah. Yeah,
good point.
Was definitely the more interesting part, at least to me, of the article. It'd be interesting to see how the airline and how the union address this. As you said, the union wants new contract, time to negotiate, because it's a different business model, a different business model for Frontier. But as you say, it's a different business model that affects apparently the cabin crew. So I think probably more coming on this story. Next up, from IdeaWorksCompany.com. So there is a survey that IdeaWorks Company has conducted, the Reward Seat Availability Survey. And they're trying to answer a question, which is, how costly is points redemption for the most popular basic reward type offered by top U.S. airlines? So they conducted a survey. They reviewed the flight award programs for a group of airlines: Alaska, American, Delta, JetBlue, Southwest, and United. And they found some interesting changes over the value, the cost of the rewards. They found that the prices of rewards, whether it's miles or points or whatever, the prices have increased significantly since 2019. And by an amount that's 7 percentage points above the rate of inflation for the same period. They also looked at reward payback for 2024. Reward payback measures the reward value provided per dollar spent on base fares. And that reward payback dropped by more than half from 2019. Also, they found that basic economy fares, they say, are disrupting the value provided by frequent flyer programs, and that's through policies that reduce or eliminate mileage and points accrual. So I think I mean, this is something I think that we may have touched on in the past, but it's something I think that we've sort of felt that the the value to the flyer of these reward programs is kind of eroding. And I don't know. I think that is going to have an impact, maybe an impact on brand loyalty. If a frequent flyer feels less committed to a particular airline because of the value they get from the rewards program, then I don't know. Marissa, wouldn't that flyer be more likely to just, you know, pick whichever airline offers other things?
Well, I'm going to say something extremely controversial. I think it's all one big game. I gave up on frequent flyer programs years ago. It's, you know, when I was traveling weekly, really, every single week of the year, practically, I was based out of Miami. That was where the business was. So really, I was part of the Advantage program because American Airlines dominated the market. So it was pretty much my only option of getting anywhere out of Miami. So then it added up, and that was useful. But in the years that followed, when I started just traveling on my own, it really just didn't make sense to keep up with the mileage program. At the same time, I know there are a lot of people who are very, very savvy about that. But really, it's a way to get people to sign up for credit cards. And it's a way to get people to not think too much about which airfare. Do airlines offer the same perks that they did before? I don't think so. And you know, you saw that big, huge upset with Delta trying to change their program. And then they had to really quickly backtrack on that because, yeah, I think the frequent flyer points are not all they're cracked up to be all the time. If you reach a certain tier and you want to maintain that tier because you're used to getting, you know, access to the lounge or whatever. But nowadays, they don't necessarily just upgrade you quickly because those seats are too valuable. So you're not really getting that benefit. The lounge access, some airlines, certainly here in Europe, it's more common. You can just pay for the lounge if you need to access it that day, and it's not that much. So, you know, that's no real difference. It's cheaper to just pay for the lounge at will when you're actually going to use it. I know that they are tremendous revenue builders for airlines. That's a big chunk of their revenue, which is not a bad thing. That's I think it's really smart that they do it. But I think from the passenger point of view, at least for myself, I just don't play that game anymore.
You know, I'm going to go back to The Journey is Reward because that podcast was founded on Brian trying to reach his lifetime 1K status with United, with Mileage Plus. And I have a hard time understanding the program, and he's explained it to me, and it's really turns out to be very simple, that with a certain number of miles and a certain number of plus points on months with an R in them on alternate Thursdays, if you're flying to a country that has a K in the name, you can get a first class seat by using enough points plus the plus points and your miles. Now, if the month does not have an R in it, and it's a country that has an N. And it goes kind of like that. It's ridiculous. And getting that status is a status thing for you, but it doesn't give you that much more. Yeah. And you don't even get treated that differently by on board or when you're trying to make a phone call or trying to get any kind of help. And I don't know what it's really done for him.
Hmm. All right. Another story. This is a little bit different. This is from, this is a TV station, WMTW. Plane lands near Poland Springs building after running low on gas. So this is this is a Cessna that ran low on fuel, made an emergency landing?
Yeah, it was a tail dragger Cessna. I think it's a 180, and they ran out of fuel up in Hollis, Maine, and landed by Poland Springs, by the bottling plant on the road. And This kind of thing has happened before, and it's happened in Maine, as I remember correctly. And originally they said the pilot was going to be filled with fuel, and he was going to take off and get out of there. But in the end, they said, well, no, I guess we're going to have to truck the plane out. But I had a couple of questions that I'm hoping, Rob, you might have some insight into. Is first of all, how do you run out of fuel? Don't you know what's in the plane? Don't you check the tabs before you take off as part of your checks? I mean, it's just a little unusual to me that you would, I mean, I can understand an emergency landing, but for lack of fuel?
Well, the one thing is we don't know where the guy started out from. And that would be the first thing I would ask. And depending on where he started out from, were the tanks full when you left? And if the person said, well, you know, it was a, we were based 200 miles away and they were full then, you know, there's some kind of mechanical issue that maybe they had a fuel leak they weren't aware of. That could be it. Or the pilot could be a numbskull, you know, who just didn't check very. I mean, most pilots will climb up on a ladder and, twist off the cap on the fuel tank and look in there just to make sure that they know what's in that tank. If it's full, it's pretty clear. It's right up to the top. Okay. I started with full tanks, but if short of that, it can be a little dicey. But believe it or not, the number of airplanes that do end up on, you know, ditching somewhere because they ran out of fuel, that's just really poor planning on the pilot's part. And it happens more often than you might think. Luckily, they're not fatally injured or anything like that most of the time. Highway, I don't know what highway he landed on. What was it, an interstate or?
No, it was a small road. Hollis is a tiny town up near Poland where the bottling plant is for the famous Poland Springs water.
Yes. Well, the only thing that is a problem when you land on a road like that is that what we usually find accompanying, a country road on one side or the other are some maybe either power lines or telephone poles or something. And it looks like this guy avoided that if there were any. But as far as being able to take off, that would be up to the FAA, and they might say, yeah, all right, just put some gas in it and go. But where are you going to come up with aviation fuel out in the middle of nowhere? I don't know how far away he was from an airport, but he probably would have had to add at least 10 or 15 gallons of gas to make it fly if he knew it wasn't a fuel leak. But how are you going to carry 10 or 15 gallons of aviation fuel from some airport back to this strip on the road and get it in there and then take off? Maybe he could, but it sounds like they decided they would just truck him out, huh?
Yeah, that's what they decided to do. There hasn't been any reports any further. Hollis isn't that far from Lymington, the home of the EAA chapter that I hang out with, the sponsor Spurwink Farm. But, it would only be a few miles. So I'm sure they could get it to him, but who knows?
It looked like the airplane belonged there, though, in front of the factory. Because it looked like he just pulled up and parked on the lawn and said, yeah, I flew in today and thought I'd grab a couple of bottles of water and head off again. And
well, Rob, let me ask you this. This is a hypothetical, but let's say that you found yourself in a situation like this pilot did. And obviously, your first choice is to get to an airport if there's one available close enough and all that. But assume that that's not the case. And it's either land on a public road or go down than try to land in a field. What are the things that would go through your head that would make you or allow you to decide where to put it down?
I think the first thing I would think of is what I mentioned before on a road. I would be afraid of telephone poles, light poles, something along the side of the road that even if I landed in the middle of the road, I could take off a wing when it hit one of those poles. And I would rather put it down in a field, a nice big wide field. And the only thing that would stop you there, maybe if it had been raining lately and you knew it was just a big mud patch, you especially with a tail dragger, if you don't touch down the right way, the tail can come up and you go over on your nose. And that's another thing you'd be concerned about. But again, people like to think, oh, well, if the engine quits, I'll just put it down on a road somewhere. That's not fair. It's not fair to the people on the ground, because there have been accidents where aircraft that had engine trouble tried to put it down on a road somewhere and they struck a car or two and hurt somebody on the ground. I'm sorry. I've always told students, put it down in a damn field. You break the airplane, that's the way it goes. Because you know what? It's insured anyway. As long as you get out in one piece, that's all I care about. But I don't think it's right to endanger people on the road.
And by the way, I just looked on a map just to double check, and that Poland Spring plant by road is about 10 miles from the Lymington Airport. By air, probably about 8.
Hmm.
So that's interesting.
But he wasn't in the air.
Apparently not. He'll have to taxi there.
All right, speaking about airports, I think we mentioned this previously, but the Board of Commissioners for the Port of Oakland, California, have voted to change the name of Oakland International Airport to San Francisco Bay Oakland International Airport. Now, why do they want to do this? Well, some of the airport officials say that travelers sometimes they fly to San Francisco's airport when their destination is actually closer to the Oakland airport. And Micah, these two airports, they're just across the bay. What are they, like 10 miles, 10, you know, as the crow flies apart, they're pretty close.
Very close to each other. And I wish that Max Trescott were here, because he lives up that way. And they're very close to each other, but it's two different cultures from the city of Oakland to the city of San Francisco. Completely different types of cities. And the San Francisco International Airport Authority is very upset with this, because they are afraid people are going to be confused and they're going to lose business. However, Southwest Airlines, that flies to Oakland and doesn't fly to San Francisco, loves the idea. And that doesn't surprise me, because Southwest Airlines had a lot to do with up here in the New England area. There's Boston Logan Airport, of course, and then there was Manchester, New Hampshire Airport, about 50 miles north of there. And Southwest didn't fly into Boston Logan, but they did fly into Manchester, New Hampshire, and now Manchester, New Hampshire is called Manchester Boston Regional. It's nowhere near Boston.
Well, I started to wonder just exactly what is the process for renaming a commercial airport? And I actually asked one of the AIs. So this is either brilliant or all garbage. I don't know which, because it's coming from an AI.
Which AI did you ask?
This one was actually appropriately enough Microsoft's Copilot. And it says that, okay, the first step is authorization and approval. That the airport authority or governing body initiates the process and they propose a new name and seek approval. The proposal is usually reviewed and approved by the relevant governing board or commission. And in some cases, public input might be sought. But then it goes into legal considerations. It says that the legal aspects are crucial, and particularly this one, because it relates to San Francisco's reaction to this renaming. It says the proposed name change should not infringe on existing trademarks or cause confusion. Well, trademark infringement is one of the things that San Francisco is claiming, and in fact, they've threatened a lawsuit. So that gets into a whole other matter. You know, I have no idea what the trademark aspects of the term San Francisco are. Who can use that? Who cannot? But that all sounds like it could get pretty messy and result in potentially a prolonged court case. I don't know how that would go.
I was reading some of the comments in this story, and one person made a point I thought was really good, is that San Francisco is a geographical, or San Francisco Bay is a geographical location. I don't know that you can necessarily trademark a geographical location. But if San Francisco has a trademark indeed on their name and this some, well, but I don't know. I don't know that they have that, or maybe this is just a con that says, hey, we've got a trademark, baby, and you can't use our, well, and then you come to find they actually don't have a trademark on it. Because we have the same problem in Chicago. I mean, we have airports in Indiana, Gary Airport. It's the Chicago Gary International Airport. The Chicago Rockford Airport, which is 70 miles northwest of O'Hare. They just did it. And I don't know, the city of Chicago didn't really have any problem with it. But then maybe the people, you know, it is California. So, you know, people...
Well, you know, I understand that something like this happened recently with the airport in Sonoma wanting to name itself a San Francisco airport. I think it was Sonoma. But it's not unusual, say, for sports stadiums. The San Francisco 49ers play in San Jose, for example. That's where the Levi's Stadium is. The New York Giants and the New York Jets play in New Jersey. So... it's interesting how these things change and grow, and all of a sudden, they names change to try to distract people into flying or traveling someplace that they may not want to go to.
Oh, the Oakland folks are just depressed because the A's are leaving, and so I think it's, you know, they're having a little problem of identity.
And they lost the Raiders.
Yes, that's true.
One last story, and this is kind of fun. Max Trescott found this one. In USA Today, there's actually something called Bark Air, B-A-R-K, Bark Air, and they offer a white paw experience, believe it or not. So this is a jet service for dogs, and it's not inexpensive, but it's very high class, I guess. So when you book a flight for your dog, you'll be contacted by a Bark Air concierge who will collect information about you and your dog and your travel plans. And then on travel day, when you and your pet arrive at the airport, there is a simple check-in process. There's no crates, no TSA checkpoints. They say a highly skilled Bark Air concierge will welcome all pups and help them settle into their experience through socialization at the gate and dog-centric cabin preparation. And then it goes on. There are calming aids, music, warm lavender-scented refreshment towels.
Is that for the dog or for the passenger?
I think that one is for the dog, actually.
Oh, okay.
There will also be... A just-in-case bag, they call it. It's going to have calming treats and leashes and poop bags.
And poop bags. Yeah, there you go. That's the just-in-case part.
Yeah, exactly. And once on board, the dogs are served their beverage of choice. It could be water. It could be bone broth or something else. But they want to make sure they don't experience any ear discomfort. You know, the change in cabin pressure, discomfort. And then there's also a variety of Bark-branded treats and snacks and surprises throughout this flight experience. So this is done in conjunction with some existing, I think, air charter service. But I don't think it says in the article who they are.
Well, those are corporate jets they're using. So,
yeah,
it has to be some charter outfit.
The basic business case of JSX, but for doves. But I don't know that there is that much of a market for people to pay $6,000 a trip for their dog. I mean, I wish them well. I think it's the cutest idea ever.
Well, it reminds me, you know, a friend of mine used to have a greyhound. His name was Zeke, and boy, was he terrific. And we always said that if we came into the lottery and won really stupid money, we wanted to get a greyhound bus that would be just for greyhounds and set it up as a kennel and just carry greyhounds around the country and transport them from place to place in luxury. And this is basically the same thing. And in fact, one of the pictures here shows a greyhound. That's what made me think of it.
Yeah, it does seem like a really limited, a very limited market.
You know, it's funny. I think somebody tried to do this a couple of years ago. This doesn't seem like a brand new idea to me. Maybe 5 or 6 years ago. But again, I mean, what kind of a market can that be? You know, $8,000 one way from New York to London's Stansted Airport. But again, does that include the human going along with them or just the dog?
I think the human, you know, the owner accompanies the dog, or somebody does, I guess. But yeah, I'm not sure if that ticket price includes both of them, or if it's $6,000 for the dog, $6,000 for the human. I don't know.
I'm sorry. A kennel is a lot cheaper. Arch, you're not coming with us anywhere. You're going to the doggy daycare place for a week.
But you know what else? Importing a dog into the UK is a big deal.
It is in terms of shots
and rabies and how long you have to be held to be observed, quarantines. This must take care of that as well, as I can only imagine.
Well, another thing that occurs to me is that people who fly business jets are oftentimes criticized for that, for environmental reasons, I guess. And someone who's flying their dogs around on business jets is going to be, I think, really, really open to criticism from, you know, from some quarters.
Well, we have listeners that fly business jets, that fly for NetJets and those like them, and as pilots. And I've been told by them that passenger wants to take the dog comes along. It's no big deal.
Absolutely true.
The people who would have the affluence to do that already can, because every single charter VIP jet service will let you bring anything short of a pony on board, because you're paying quite a lot to fly with them. So it's going to be fine.
Again, we're speaking with Marissa Garcia. Marissa, tell us a little bit about Flight Chic and what people can expect to find there.
Well, Flight Chic is sort of my place to share all the lovely things, if you will, and to occasionally be opinionated about the industry in a way that will not upset any of my editors, because that would be me. But basically, I just share all of the latest reveals of cabins and lovely menus that airlines are giving out, a lot of passenger experience announcements. I'm also very carefully tracking the sustainability argument and in terms of the development of sustainable aviation fuel, which is going to be a major requirement for airlines. So that I'm just personally interested in seeing how that evolves. And cabin safety matters, of course, because it's very close to my heart. Regulatory matters. Although most of my coverage of regulatory matters these days is happening more on my Forbes column, because I find that my Forbes readers are really following that very closely. I think even before, of course, the events of this year with Boeing, but since then, it's become something that my readers on Forbes want to know more about. So Flight Chic is a great place to go and find out all kinds of curiosities about aircraft cabins. And if you want to talk business, then read my Forbes column.
So the frequency of your writing is pretty significant too, I think. This is not a once a week or once a month kind of posting arrangement. You really do produce quite a bit of content.
I try to. It's some days is easier than others, but I try to have at least one post a day every day. I'll miss the occasional Sunday because then I do my newsletter, of course, which is a good wrap up of everything. And I try to make that special for subscribers by just giving a little bit more perspective on the news than I might do if I'm just doing straight reporting. But yeah, I cover On Flight Chic. I also write for my regular outlets. And then with the column on Forbes, try to provide some more broader, bigger perspectives on the things of the business of flight.
Is there a topic or an area of aviation that's kind of prominent in your mind these days?
Safety is always prominent in my mind. It has been from the beginning because of, you know, working with safety equipment. Again, yes, we made aircraft interiors, but we also were focused quite a lot on safety. And actually, aircraft interiors are a huge safety item. We had to do all kinds of flammability testing and things like that. So I became really a safety geek, a regulatory geek in that sense. Worked very closely with the FAA, with what became EASA. And with other regulators in other regions of the world as well. So that is always my number one topic where I really like to deep dive into reports and both accident reports and audit reports. And I try to figure out, because there's a special language all of these things are written in that is intended to mystify you. And the thing is that when I first started, I think if you haven't noticed, I'm a woman. When I first started in the industry, people were just really underestimating how committed I might be to pulling the mystery out of all of these regulations. And then, you know, I got really good at it. I love a challenge. So I just dove into all of those. And really got to, you know, I've written TSO applications. That's a technical standard order application for a product to be evaluated by regulators and proven to be effective at the standard that it's supposed to be functioning. And so, yeah, I get really, really into that. And that is a big part of when I write on Forbes, is especially with all of the news that's been breaking about Boeing and other issues that have come up. I've really been able to use those skills.
I'm curious, what sparked you to become a safety geek? Was it your association with those kinds of products and services, or was there something else that occurred to you that kind of drove you in that direction?
Yes. Well, definitely working in the sector was the introduction. But what happened was I went to the FAA CAMI facility in Tulsa, Oklahoma, one of my first trips while I was working with the business. And this was like in 1995. because we were trying to certify a particular product that needed to be tested in the very deep pool that they have there. Because you had to be pretending to jump from the height of a plane 10 meters into the water and be able to not crash and hurt yourself. You know, it has to be a very deep pool when you're jumping from that height. And just watching that, just watching the process of how people go and test these things to be destroyed, seeing how the fire lab burns things and how quickly the flames rise. And all, to me, it was fascinating. So maybe I'm just, I don't know, an adrenaline junkie in that sense. So just liking to see things be broken and put back together again. But that fascinated me. And I decided, wow, I really did do the right thing taking this job. And I loved working with the regulators and the engineers. They're just such really sometimes underestimated people in the sense of you know, everybody is the people who make the money are very flash and very important in the industry, but the people who make the planes are more so, because, you know, it's a miracle that we fly. It really is. I mean, it's science and it's physics, but it's still a darn miracle that we fly safely every day. So yeah, I just love it. I love all of that.
And so how long has Flight Chic been operating?
I started in 2013. Like I said, the company I used to work for closed in 2010. I took a couple of years off and worked on creative writing, believe it or not, which is another passion of mine. And then I decided, you know what? I really need to just write about the stuff I know about. Opened up Flight Chic one November in 2013. And have continued writing since. During the COVID pandemic, I took a little bit of a break in terms of, I was still reporting for other outlets, but not so much on Flight Chic. I needed a break. I think it was just a very hard time, I think, for the whole world at that time. And I didn't have anything fun and lovely to report on. And I said, I'm just going to give myself some space here. But I came back. And it's been going on since.
So where is it? You mentioned the, there's the website. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can learn more about Flight Chic and the different options? I know I subscribe to your newsletter, but there's also the website. And, you know, kind of explain all that for our listeners.
Sure. Well, flightchic.com is the website. So flight and then chic.com. And on Forbes, you can just look for Marissa Garcia on Forbes. If you click the blue button, I get a piece of candy. So be nice and click the blue button to follow. So that would be lovely. And then you can follow me on Twitter at DesignerJet, on Instagram at DesignerJet. And I also have a Facebook page that is Flight Chic, and on YouTube as Flight Chic. But you can find all of those links on my website. There's handy buttons that you can just click and follow.
Marissa, you just wrote an article about the 797, a plane that we've been waiting for 30 years. But nonetheless, what are your thoughts on the 797? I said we were going to have 797 questions or thoughts on today's show, but what are your thoughts about it? Tell us a little bit about the article and what made you decide to write it.
Well, back in 2018, I wrote about the opportunity that aircraft could be for Boeing in the day, and how long it had already been postponed. And just recently, I don't know if you follow Air Insight, Addison Shulman. He's a very good analyst and someone I've met on at Airbus tour of one of their aircraft. And he's just a very smart man. And I wrote him, I always like to write him and ask, and sort of pick his brain for crazy notions that I get sometimes about the industry. I said, Addison, honestly, what would you say? Am I completely, you know, off base, or is there really still a market for the 797? I think there is. What do you think? And he said, yeah, absolutely. It is still a very necessary plane. The 757 is a wonderful aircraft, and the, you know, airlines would buy more of those if they, you know, if they could. And the 767 as well, but they need replacement. The 737 MAX program is not enough to cover the range and the capacity that airlines really will need. And Boeing needs to put energy into it. And when I saw Liam News, who's also very, very informative, I enjoy their reporting as well. When I saw that Calhoun had mentioned that his successor, and I think this first came up with Aviation Week, but the point is that his successor would need to decide on the next aircraft program and would probably need a budget of $50 billion. And I thought, well, you know, that's quite a lot of money. And I saw Liam News make the same point. That's a lot of money. But so what? You know what? They spent that much on the Dreamliner. And they spent part of that money in making up for errors. If they can spend that much on getting the right plane that airlines need to get into the next stage of demand, we know it's going to double, which may seem incredible, but passenger numbers are going to double again. So if we can get the right capacity aircraft that has the right range, we can really solve a lot of trouble in the years to come. Because it will be easier. We cannot hire enough pilots to fly all the narrow bodies long ways the way airlines have been trying to do for the past few years. We can probably not build enough wide bodies to do what Japan Airlines does and fly everyone on domestic A350s. You know, there may be an argument for that in some cases, but that middle of the market plane is just going to really be invaluable. And at the end of the day, Boeing should always be an engineering company. And you cannot have engineers be bored. Engineers need to be engineering. So, you know, get those, you know, brain waves working and build a better plane than Boeing's ever built before. They could do it. Absolutely.
And when you say middle of the market, you know, you mentioned the 757, which is a single aisle. The other ones that would be in there, are we talking about a 757 replacement or a 767-300 replacement or an A310? I've flown on all of those, and they're medium-sized airplanes. They're none of them are being made anymore.
Exactly. But that's the problem. There is demand for that. Those planes should never have been stopped to be made. We need that range. In other words, it's a Goldilocks scenario. You know, it's not too big. It's not too small. It's just right. It's right in the middle. It will allow more flexibility to change routes, because if you commit a larger aircraft, you're already limiting the number of airports where you can land. So, you know, having a middle aircraft that will have just as much route flexibility, be able to fit more people in a single flight, and at the same time have pretty good economics in terms of operation, because you're not flying a big bird. It's, you know, not going to be significantly more fuel hungry than a narrow body. I think it just makes sense for the industry right now. We see that not everyone, but United Airlines, I think even today, if Boeing were to say, okay, you know what, we fixed it and we're going to get you all your MAX 10s, they would leap for joy and they would buy them out. They meant that they wanted that plane. They definitely wanted that plane. But even that plane would not completely satisfy their needs as well as the 797. So it's really just a matter of thinking a little bit for the future. And again, keeping the practice of engineering going. Because if you're not developing aircraft, if you're just manufacturing old designs, you're in trouble. You need to keep your engineering base active and engaged. Otherwise, it's too long a career to learn too many complexities of how things work. It should almost be like a vocation that goes with apprenticeships, where you're always teaching the next generation what you know, because there's too much to learn. And I saw that even what we built was nothing as complex as an aircraft. It were only elements of what things that go in an aircraft. But I saw that with our own team. If you didn't have your engineers actively working and passing on knowledge to younger engineers, you were in trouble.
In some ways, engineering is kind of like a muscle. You know, if you don't use it, exercise it, it atrophies and it loses its effectiveness. But this is kind of a tough time for Boeing to embark on a new program financially. You know, it's a lot of money, and Boeing has got its issues right now. It's management has got its hands full. It's kind of tough. A lot of times it's about timing of these things. And I don't know if this is the right time.
Well, You're absolutely right. It is. But that's the key thing. It's about timing. The thing is that Boeing is currently encountering a very dark time that they have encountered before and they have come out of before. So, you know, and Calhoun has made this clear. Boeing will come out of this. They will sort themselves out. And I believe that they have the wherewithal to do that. What they have to fix in their safety management systems is serious, and it needs to be addressed, because some of the things like not knowing where the documentation is for the door plug, to me, I described it as a baffling revelation the day it came out, because I know for a fact that there is no such thing as we didn't document this work. That just doesn't fly within regulatory requirements. You document everything. But anyway, the point is that, yes, they're in trouble, but they're not hardly broke. If even the U.S. government had to give them a pass to help them get this plane built, they could get that to happen. So, you know, they're fine. If they needed to raise the funds to do it, I think Boeing could manage to do that. They could just, for example, stop buying back stock for a while and just use capital to improve products, which is a radical way of trying to do business these days. But it works, you know, to reinvest in your company instead of in stockholders. So, boy, I'm going to make myself a very popular gal.
Well, it sounds like the 797 could be the project that Boeing uses to drag themselves out of the hole and, in effect, be their moonshot to bring them back to where they were.
That's a perfect way to put it, because, yes, it is a moonshot. It is absolutely a moonshot, and it is as critical and as apparently untimely a thing as the U.S. did with getting to the moon. You know, nobody was really in a hurry to do that for the longest time. Then, you know, Russia came close and the U.S. said, okay, this has got to happen now. It's that kind of a situation right now for the airline industry. And I think that affects more people without taking away at all from the wonders of space exploration, but in terms of the advances that yielded. But flying safely every day affects so many people around the world that, if they should take that $50 billion and say, okay, we're gonna take a hit right now and find that money and just get it done. It will also, I think, make a big change within Boeing in terms of restoring employee pride and restoring employee well-being and security, which is critical. You need to have employees who they must. I really feel for everyone working there right now, because I know from having worked with them before, they're fine people who really work very hard at what they do and who are very caring about their company. They love their company.
Sure. Yes.
It's a good article on Forbes, and I found it by just putting in Forbes and Boeing 797, and it came right up. And Marissa, it was published the day we're recording this, which is April 15th, and it came out this morning. And we'll have a link to it in the show notes. And if our listeners want to find it, they can also find it by looking it up that way.
Very good. All right, Marissa, it's been a great conversation. There's so many topics that we can talk to you about, and it's always a joy to explore them. And commercial aviation is not boring. there is so many things going on, so many possibilities. We'll have to wait and see what happens. I think it'll be exciting no matter how things turn out. Boeing is certainly a topic that's on top of mind for most people interested in the industry and the implications of what they do and how they do it and how they change their business is critical. It's critical for the company. It's critical for the industry and probably for the United States as well. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been just the most fun night I've spent up late in a long time. So
you got to get out more.
I do. do. Well, you know, I live out in the countryside, so I'm pretty much out.
What's up with the geeks? Let's see, Micah, you're just recently back from a little adventure up north.
Yeah, I went to visit some friends up north in Aroostook County in Mars Hill and saw the solar eclipse. And it was just a wonderful experience from beginning to end. I've never seen so many potato fields in my life. It's potato fields wherever you look up there. Other than having to deal with a pretty horrible hotel situation that I refused to stay in and insisted they give me my deposit back and finally got it, the rest was just great. My friends put me up for an extra night. I got to visit the National Weather Service office in Caribou, which was a real treat. It was really fun. On Sunday morning, I got to, for the first time in my life, visit a sugar house where they distill maple syrup, and it's 40 gallons of maple sap to 1 gallon of syrup. And boy, is it worth every gallon. Just absolutely delicious. Got to send some to Rob and share it with him. So the Caribou and the Presque Isle airports, and then the eclipse, completely indescribable. I know you've all seen pictures, but experiencing it is, it's just unbelievable what it was like. Nothing like it at all. And perhaps the best part is Mars Hill is a huge mountain with big windmills on it. And it was to the east of where my friends live, and the sun comes up over it. But after the eclipse was over and it came out of totality, the sun rose from the west on it. And it was just amazing to see. Just really, really beautiful. It was a great weekend. And that's why I wasn't here last week. But, you know, I didn't miss you at all.
Now, Brian Coleman is off on a bit of a trip right now.
Yeah, as we're recording this, Brian is on his way to Singapore. And actually, he's probably sitting in the United Polaris Lounge right now in San Francisco, having a few pre-flight cocktails. But he's headed to Singapore for a while. And there's actually a meetup that's scheduled in Singapore. It's going to happen on either the 19th or 20th of April, as you're listening to this. It's going to take place at Level 33, which is a really unique and award-winning rooftop dining place that's also happens to be the world's highest urban brewery. It's high up on this, in this building. So we're not exactly sure what day or what time, but if you want to meet up with him, you can follow him on Twitter or X or whatever you call it. And that ID is TJIT. The journey is the TJIT reward. And should be a lot of fun.
Sounds great. God, I wish I was there. So, Micah, you and Rob might not know this, but after we recorded last week's episode, I actually had a call with Brian Coleman and ended up recording it and kind of slipped it into the middle of the episode. And this is about the flight team internship that is a project from the California Science Center. And it's a truly interesting, remarkable, and I think important project where they take some students, some high school students, disadvantaged high school students, and for the summer internship program, they expose them to all kinds of aviation topics. They get an opportunity to get in and see things that they otherwise wouldn't, explore possible aviation career opportunities. It's just a wonderful, wonderful project. And if you listen to last week's episode, then you'll have heard that. But I think what I'm going to do is, for those of you who may have missed last week's episode, at the end of this episode, when we close it out, the very tail end, I think I'm going to put that conversation with Brian Coleman in there again. So if you've already heard it, you can just, you know, cut out there. But if you haven't heard it, I think it's something that you might want to listen to. They're looking for some support from people who are in the aviation industry, people who can contribute some things to make this a successful internship for these high school students this summer. So look forward to that at the end of the show. Let's see. One item, a shout out. Micah, what have you got for us?
Well, NASA's DC-8 is finally retiring. It's the largest airborne science lab in the world, and they're retiring it. I don't know what or if they're going to replace it with. They've had it since 1986, and it sort of reminds me of Tom Swift and his flying lab, which I read when I was just a kid. I read a lot of the Tom Swift series, and this plane did some amazing things, did some wonderful, wonderful research, and it's one of the last DC-8s that's still flying. There's only 5 left registered in the world. 3 of them are operated by a Peruvian cargo airline called Skybus, although we don't know if they're still flying. One of them is a Congolese cargo airline called Transair Cargo. It's listed as being active, but nobody's seen it fly in years. And then there was this NASA aircraft, and one by Samaritan's Purse. It's a humanitarian relief organization. So there's not many left. It's a great plane. I've flown on DC-8s. United used to have a number of the Super 70 series flying until the late 80s. Very comfortable plane. It was also the first aircraft I ever flew on, so it's near and dear to my heart. Sorry to see it go.
And you found an article in The Aviationist, right? And we'll have that in the show notes for sure.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest this episode was Marissa Garcia, flightchic.com. Marissa, oh, it's so great to have you on the show. I'm so happy you were able to stay awake the whole thing.
Thank you. Thank you all so much. I had a great time.
And, of course, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. The direct link to the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/795. That's the episode number. And our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Micah, how do people find you?
Well, you can find me with Brian when he's back in the country on the Journey is Reward podcast. Not sure what episode we're coming up on, but they're always a lot of fun. We just recorded one yesterday about a trip to Oregon to wine country on a Velo Airlines. And it's an interesting time. And you can also find me on Twitter if you want to get me directly. I'm still there, one of the few remaining people, but I'm hanging in there. And that ID there is Mainfly, M-A-I-N-E, because I am your main man here in the state of Maine. Fly like let's go fly, Mainfly on Twitter.
All right. And how about you, Rob Mark?
Anything that has jet wine in the title, except that I found on YouTube there was a fellow that tried to take jet wine from me, and I fought him for it, and I won.
Good.
Except that one of my YouTube aliases is now the real jet wine, and I'm really bummed about that. But that's okay. We'll get into that part later. And occasionally on Aviation News Talk with Max Trescott, who just didn't happen to be here tonight.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the website 30,000feet.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Nighty night.
Good night. Thank you.
And thanks for listening.
I'm here with our friend Brian Coleman. Brian, it's nice to be speaking with you again, and especially on an interesting topic here. And I understand that there's a project that's being undertaken by the California Science Center, in that you have some involvement in this project.
I do. I've been asked to help out in their summer intern program, and it's called Flight Team. And what the Science Center is doing, they're going to some underprivileged high schools in Los Angeles, and they have this intern program for 11th and 12th graders, so juniors and seniors, that are interested in aviation. And this is a summer intern program to get them involved and really sort of spearhead, champion their enthusiasm towards aviation and show them really what the industry is all about.
Wow, what a great thing to do. Is this something that's brand new for them?
It is. This is the first year that they're doing it. They're hoping that it will be a success and they'll continue on in future years. So part of the problem, and really the reason why I'm on the show tonight, is we have a lot of development to do. Mm-hmm. Right? In building out courseware and curriculum, there's just a lot of stuff that needs to happen.
Well, what are some examples of the program and the kinds of activities that these students would be involved in?
It's an immersive program where they learn about aviation, really from the physics of flight through careers in aviation and really every aspect. And as we've covered on the show, there's really a never-ending list of topics that you can talk about in regards to aviation. And of course, most people think about being a pilot and that's it. But as we know, there's so much more than that that goes on that makes up the industry of aviation.
Of course. And so the intent here is to expose these students to all of these different kinds of opportunities for possible careers in the aviation field.
Exactly. So it's not only commercial flight, which I think most people think of, but there's the engineering aspect, the air traffic control, the flight operations. There's so many different parts. And the idea in this 8-week program is to introduce the kids to each of these segments and hopefully continue to foster their interest in it and help them along the way.
This is a great thing. I think there's nothing more meaningful, perhaps, that we can do than help younger people get the exposure, develop the interest in them, or allow them to develop their own interests in this area. Bringing the youngsters in is always a good thing in filling the pipeline, but also bringing a variety of different types of students in to the field. Just kind of strengthens the field, I think.
Yeah, and for me, that's really what piqued my interest in this, is the Science Center is in a disadvantaged neighborhood. They're focusing on high schools that have disadvantaged students. And in particular, again, what really drew me into this was they really wanted to focus on young girls. So yes, the program's opened up to boys as well, but they really want to skew it to a 60-40 or 80-20 membership in this intern program. So they really want to help these kids. And again, as we've said so many times on the show, if you don't see someone doing the job, you just don't see it as a possibility of you doing it. And that's why I'm really excited to help them out and bring in different resources and aspects to this program.
And so this is a program that's starting this summer, which is fast approaching. What is it that is needed to get this started in a successful way?
Yeah, so this is an 8-week program, and it starts in late June. And the first part of it is really going to be the science of flight or the physics of flight. The second part of the program is going to be really an introduction to careers and all the different things that kids can go and gain employment in the industry. So what we need is basically everything. So my ask for the Airplane Geeks audience is, especially if you're located in Southern California, but that's not a limiting factor, but if you're in Southern California and you work for a commercial airline, you work at an airport, you work in an engineering firm that supports aviation, if there's anything that you could do, if you think that you could donate an hour of time and lecture for these kids, you know, give a presentation over what your job is. If you are a software developer and have flight sim software, if you're an expert in flight sim software and can talk about that, if you are in education and can provide any materials over courseware or talk about the future of education, you know, where they could go, different degree programs. You know, if you're a private pilot and would be willing to have some students, and we're talking 8 students here or 8 interns, come and view your airplane and go through how you create a flight plan, why a weather report's important, why you do weight and balance. Just show the kids the different aspects of what's inside the hangar, right, the different parts of the airplane and just let them see and possibly touch. So it's really anybody that has anything that they think they can offer, I would love to talk with them and fit them into the schedule.
This is great. And this is a voluntary kind of effort, correct, on the part of the people that might be contributing something to the program?
Correct. Yeah. For example, my bit is 100% voluntary. However, because the California Science Center is a nonprofit agency, if somebody contributes something, we have the ability to write the in-kind donation letter. So the value of whatever you contribute can be deducted. And it could be even something if you work for a company that has some t-shirts or some lanyards or notebooks or whatever that's logoed with your company name on it. We're quite happy to accept that and put that into the gift bag for these students. And again, you would get the tax deduction paperwork for that contribution that you've made.
Well, Brian, how can people contact you if they have something that they might be able to offer?
Oh, the best way to get a hold of me is send an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Well, that's pretty easy.
It is. The same email address I've had for years.
That's right. And this is requires kind of a timely response because, as we mentioned, the program is starting soon. So people who can contribute something should do that right away or contact you right away, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we're really looking for everything. And I would say if you're on the fence over, well, should I contribute? Would this really make sense? Please get a hold of me and it'll be really easy for me to say either yes or no. I would much rather have way too many people volunteer stuff than people be hesitant, but we could actually use it. And again, I'm really looking for things in every aspect of aviation. If it's commercial, private, cargo operations, again, you know, if you're a flight planner, if you're a dispatcher, anything at all that you could possibly contribute, I think would be a nice addition to this program.
Well, Brian Coleman, you're a good man, and this is a really worthy project. I'm happy that you're part of it because you can make things happen. And yeah. I think the students may not see all that goes on behind the scenes to get it set up, but I think they're going to really appreciate the result when it all is said and done. So thank you, Brian.
And thank you, and thank you to everyone who considers contributing to this program. We really appreciate it, and I'm sure the kids will too.
Yes.